Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, MOTAT.
Indeed.
Ellen.
Lillian.
Tell me about new measurements and a proton's radius. Yes,
you haven't read this, have you?
I read all the numbers and I was like, no. No, thank you.
No, fair enough. Okay, so how big are atoms, I guess?
Very small.
They are very small. Okay, we'll talk more about that in a minute, about just how small they are. But as all of you listeners out there know, I hope, when we're talking about atoms, we're talking about their constituents. They're made up of three things generally. They're made up of protons, neutrons, electrons.
I did know that.
You did know that?
Yep.
Yes.
Yep.
And they are very small. So it's of interest to know exactly how small they are, because we want to measure, you know, everything in the universe, from the very big to
made
the very, very small, which, yes.
All made from atoms.
Absolutely, yeah. So, it had long been thought that the proton had a radius of a whole 88 femtometers. Right,
okay,
here we go.
Okay, so a femtometer.
A femtometer. A femtometer is 10 to the power of minus 15 meters.
Are you going to say that in numbers?
0.00000. Okay, lots of zeros in front of it, obviously, okay? So ridiculously small. Ridiculously small, so small that we can't really comprehend just how small that is, okay? And this is, you know, part of your fundamental building block of all matter, the proton. So, and how did they do this? How did they find out that the proton had that particular radius? They did that in two ways. They did that with a thing called electron diffraction, okay? So, or electron scattering, in fact. And basically, this works because you shoot electrons very, very rapidly at protons, and when they get near to protons, they sort of get scattered,
mm-hmm.
okay? So instead of hitting them, they get scattered. And from the way they get scattered, you can then figure out the dimensions of the proton through methods that we're certainly not going to go through here. Another way of doing it is to look at the photons that get emitted from electrons when they do that sort of thing, when they collide with a proton. So they had used both of these methods back in the past, and they both got an answer of 88 femtometers, okay? Now, this month in Nature, they have just published the results of a study they did in the States using very, very, very fancy equipment, using this electron scattering technique again, and what they found now is they've got a new value of the radius of the proton, 0.831 femtometers.
Wow.
I know. Huh?
Okay, so they did a different study. They measured it differently to get a new measurement.
Yeah, essentially. So they upgraded their way of doing it. Okay. So they've gone from 0.88 femtometers down to 0.831 femtometers, which you might not think is a big deal. You know, it's about 4 or 5% different, which is in fact an enormous deal.
Amount.
So
yes.
That's a huge amount. So they're pretty confident that they now have the real value of the radius of the proton.
What does that mean?
Well,
What does this change?
What does this change? It changes. It changes things fundamentally, really, in terms of the size of all of our atoms.
So we've been measuring stuff wrong for all this time. That's what you're telling me.
Well, not so much wrong, just not as accurately as we could have done it. Okay. But let's not concentrate on that so much. Okay, so this is great. 0.831 femtometers, whoop-de-doo. It's not going to mean anything to anybody other than those who are really interested in this sort of stuff. But let's just have a very, very quick general talk about just how small this is. Okay, so we're talking about atoms, and the protons are at the nucleus of an atom. So on a comparative scale, if we were going to consider the size of the whole atom relative to a single proton, that would be around about the same scale as taking a pea and putting it in the middle of Eden Park. So the pea would be your proton, and you know, the surrounds, the confines of Eden Park would basically be the rest of the atom. So you've got a factor of around about 10 to the power of 5, sort of 100,000 times difference between the actual size of the proton and the size of the atom itself. So as good old Ernest Rutherford said, most of the mass of the atom is in the nucleus, most definitely, okay?
Yeah.
And this is an example I really, really like to use, and so I'm going to put you two on the spot now.
Oh,
okay.
So we've got a 10-cent piece, okay? Yes. Good old New Zealand 10-cent piece. Weighs around about, I think, 3.5 grams, something like that. Made predominantly of steel. A little bit of copper in there. Okay, and we're going to count all the atoms in that 10-cent piece. Okay, and we're going to count them at a rate of 1 atom per second. We're going to go 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, we're going to count them all.
Yeah.
How long is it going to take to count them all?
A fucking long time. I'm not going to. We can't okay, do it during the show.
Do you want to
quantify
that a little bit more?
At least a month.
At least a month?
To the end of the universe.
To the end of the universe. We don't know how long it is to the end of the universe.
Exactly.
It'll take that long.
But you're kind of on the right track there.
Oh, wow.
You are kind that of on the long. Right track. It would take around about 80,000 times the age of the universe currently. Okay. Mm. So the universe now is 13.4 billion years old. Okay. So multiply that by 80,000 times, and that's the amount of time that it would take you to count all of the atoms in a 10-cent piece, in a lousy little 10-cent piece.
Mm.
So that gives you some idea how tiny they are. And even more amazing, if you take all of those atoms in your 10-cent piece and you put them in a chain. Okay, so you just take all the atoms, make a chain out of them, single atom chain. It's going to go around the Earth around about 100,000 times.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. Okay, that's
so,
pretty amazing.
So, mind... blown.
Yeah, a little bit. Okay.
So there you go. Yeah.
The next story, why is ice so slippery?
Indeed. Why is ice so slippery? And again, this is the sort of thing that you'd think, shit, they've got to have that figured out by now. Surely, you know, ice is slippery.
Is.
We all know it is slippery. But do we really know why it's slippery? And
because it's essentially water.
Yeah, water.
Water. Okay, water's the thing. Okay. So... we've got a fair idea of why it slips. You're mentioning water, and you would probably know that if you get out there and the ice is bone dry, then it's not particularly skiddy, slippery, whatever.
Yeah.
And then you know, put a little bit of water on it, all of a sudden, vomp, very, very slippery. So, workers in France have just published a paper on why ice is so slippery, believe it or not, the year 2019. So, let's use the good old ice skating analogy. How does ice skating work? Because we know that, you know, people on ice skates can glide across the ice. And the way that that works is that, right, your blades on an ice skate are very, very thin. And so therefore they exert a hell of a lot of pressure on the ice below, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, ice has got a very unusual property, or ice, water, whatever, is that the melting point of ice decreases when you increase the pressure. So in other words, at very, very high pressure, water doesn't freeze until, you know, like -2, -3, something like that. Or the opposite, it melts at, you know, -2, -3. So what happens is that you exert a pressure on the ice, and as soon as you do that in the region where you're exerting the pressure, the ice is going to melt.
Wow.
Okay, because it's at 0 degrees at that point in time. You put some pressure on it. If it's still at 0 degrees, it's going to melt.
So ice skaters are just melting the ice as they go along.
No, exactly. That's exactly right. Wow. So you've got this tiny, tiny thin, I was going to say sheet of ice, layer of water between the ice skate and the ice. And that's what is helping you. Okay. Now, the weird thing is, water's not the world's best lubricant, is it?
No.
When you think about it, it's really a lousy lubricant. You know?
Yeah.
So compared to something like oil, for example, something's got to be sort of viscous. You know, it's got to be sort of thick and stuff like that in order to be a decent lubricant. Certainly a hell of a lot sort of thicker, quote unquote, than water is. So what these French researchers decided to try and do was to actually look at the layer of water and see if they could see what is going on there. So the very, very thin layer that gets formed. And what they found was that, number one, the layer was extraordinarily thin, way thinner than people had thought before. And so it was less than a micron thick, okay?
Wow.
And a micron is 10 to the minus 6 meters, or a thousandth of a millimeter, which you can probably visualize that a little bit better. Or if you take a human hair, and you might think, shit, you know, it's really small, I can't comprehend that. You take a human hair is around about 50 microns, roughly,
okay,
in diameter or radius, I can't remember which, but you can easily feel that with your fingers. You can feel that very, very small. Size. So they found that this layer of water is really, really thin, And when they actually analysed the water, and using very, very, very interesting techniques, what they found was that, yes, that actual water didn't behave like bulk normal water. And in fact, it was a lot more viscous than bulk normal water. And in fact, the example they use in the paper that they wrote was sort of like a slushy, or sort of like an ice cone or something like that. Sort of like a mixture of ice and water.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's kind of cool. So that now is the definitive explanation, I guess, of why ice is slippery. Because, yes, you do get a layer of water, but this layer of water is not, well, doesn't have the properties of actual water itself, of the water that we know.
Right.
So kind of interesting, and obviously more research is going to be
required. Okay.
But this brings to mind, if I may digress for 2 seconds, there was a thing way back in the 60s called polywater that was discovered by the Soviets way back when, in the days of the Cold War. And what they supposedly found is that if you put water in very, very thin capillaries, okay, very, very, very thin, so pieces of glass, you know, it's hollow pieces of glass that are very, 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 very thin, okay? And if you know about capillary action, you'll know that if you put one of those in water, the water shoots up the capillary, okay? And they found that when they had this water trapped in these capillaries, they reckoned that water had all these weird properties, that it boiled at a way different temperature and it was way different viscosity and blah, 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 blah. And this sort of sent the scientific world on its head, because they thought, oh, shit, you know, this is amazing. Water's different now.
Different,
all you've got to do is constrain it into these little capillaries and it changes its properties and everything. And so this got a whole lot of work, and of course the Americans are really interested in this because they couldn't be one-upped by the Russians, you know. Americans did a lot of study, and eventually they found what had actually happening was that the water was dissolving a little bit of the glass, and they're ending up with a solution of sort of silica. Anybody interested in reading that, it's quite an interesting story. Just Google polywater, and it'll tell you all about it.
Okay, we're going to have to do this one quickly.
We are going to do this quickly,
Ellen.
Yes.
Cleaning product dangers.
Yeah, I know. This is terrible. So in Boston, a fast food restaurant last week, the manager sadly passed away in hospital after cleaning up, or attempting to clean up, a mixture of 2 cleaning materials. So one was just called communal carton bleach, which, hell, we've all got in our houses. And the other one was a sort of an anti-scaling, a descaling material, which has got acid in it. So it's got a bit of nitric acid, a bit of phosphoric acid in it. And again, you know, like a rust remover sort of thing. And again, probably lots of us have got that in our homes. And very, very sadly, what happened was that the two ended up mixing together. So we mixed up sodium hypochlorite, which is bleach, with this acidic material, and what happens when you do that? You end up with chlorine, so Cl2, which you sure as hell don't want, because, you know, that was the first quote-unquote chemical weapon that was used in World War One. They used chlorine gas. And so sadly this guy was overcome by chlorine gas. So this acts as a very, very important, I guess, message to everybody, that the stuff that you've got in your kitchen cupboard is potentially nasty. Take those warnings seriously.
Right.
Okay? Especially just bleach. You keep bleach away from anything, A, that's acidic, because you will release chlorine, or B, you keep it the hell away from ammonia. Okay? Concentrated ammonia, because you'll end up with things called chloramines, which will do nasties to you as well. So
would that be a general rule, just not to mix stuff together?
Yes. Yeah.
We put chlorine in pools.
That's fine.
Small
amounts.
And it's not gas.
It's not Cl2. It's Cl2 chlorine is the stuff that'll kill you.
Okay.
What happens? You dissolve chlorine in water. As long as it's not acidic, you end up with hyperchlorite or hypochlorous acid, and those things are relatively benign. But, you know, you gotta be very, very careful. I was doing a bit of DIY in the weekend, and you know, headed down to the old hardware store for a bit of paint stripper, and found one of them that was basically pure, a thing called DMSO, dimethyl sulfoxide. Now, this is stuff that we chemists use in the laboratory, and it's bloody dangerous stuff. So, honestly, if you're doing any paint stripping and you end up with that stuff, for God's sake, use big, thick rubber gloves, because this stuff goes straight through your skin.
Oof.
I know, because I've done it. It goes straight through your skin, and then you taste it in about 5 seconds after you put it on your skin. It carries through anything that's dissolved in it into your bloodstream as well. That's the nasty stuff. So there you go. Please be careful with chemicals, folks. Please.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Alan. Talk in 2 weeks.
Absolutely, we will. See ya.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.